Shawshank.
Later, take a hike.
Hey, Electric Company. Kiss my ass. All right, here we go.
Let's go fall off a stage like somebody built Cosby's.
Wow.
It's a super deep cut.
I like, so many sunny. Bill Cosby's. Because so many Bill Cosby's is a nightmare host right now. It is. It's that time again, ladies and gentlemen. It is time for recommended reading with Hey Kids Comics. I am Andrew Farmer. With me, as always, is the Jedi Cole Houston.
Good evening. Yes, this will be recommending a few of our favorite comic books, graphic fiction, if you will.
linear fiction, linear narrative. Yeah.
Serialized fiction is where we'll be perusing the vastly libraries of the, and I'm going to constantly change my accent throughout the. So I'm a Muppet character now.
Jeez. So yeah, we do this. Honestly, I went back and did some research. It's almost quarterly. This is almost a quarterly feature because there's so much.
Weird. It's like getting like the quarterly buzz there. It's just like,
That's how much time it takes us to read new comics. That's the thing. It's like, it takes about 4 months for us to build up a repertoire of stuff that we actually want to suggest. Because while all comics are good, some comics are better than others. And that's what we're here to talk about tonight.
And some comics are the best.
And disclaimer up front, if we repeat ourselves, we're old, we're sorry.
Yeah, I was going to mention that if you're more familiar with what we said on the show than we who said it, number one, you're not us, and number two, and God bless you for that, because we could use some memory of what we've said here. And number two, again, like Andy said, we're old people. We often, combine the collective number of years that we've read comics, and oddly enough, that is the actual number of years our brains have been slowly, addling away. It's sort of strange synthesis there of our combined chronologies.
Well,
like the lamest firestorm ever.
And if you do know, if you've listened to this and we repeat ourselves and you're like, wait a second, they already talked about this comic in X, Y, or Z. Thank you. Thank you for listening for that long. You should get a damn prize.
We talked about that. We actually carved out some niche inside your brain to be wasted on our words.
That's right. And you might be using more than 9% of your brain. Again, we should release the opening bits that we do for each other in some kind of Patreon paywall that you guys can give us $3 and then listen to our insane ramblings like the mouth of madness.
I would pay to listen to that because I'm kind of curious to know what I said.
Right. So do you want to start with a suggestion or would you like me to start with a suggestion?
I think I'm going to let you lead because I've had an inkling of something cross my mind from the when I was in my trench earlier.
Yeah, you went in that trench.
I went in my trench. And I've got an idea that I want to pursue, so I'm going to need to do a little looking here real quick.
Okay, so my first one. Now, I was telling Cole this prior. This is a first for Hey Kids Comics. All of my suggestions are going to be from like the last 2 to 3 years. I'm not going to take you back, even though I will say this right now, I'm rereading God Loves, Man Kills right now because Paul suggested it the other day and it was free on whatever app, so I just downloaded it and started reading it like on the Marvel app for
damn
something.
Millennial.
Yeah, I know. I'm actually reading 2 collected editions in paper, 1 collected edition digital. Like, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I'm so confused. But my first book, if you haven't started reading it yet, I can't suggest it enough. If you're burnt out on Walking Dead, I know a lot of people are getting there. Try pick up Kirkman's Outcast. They just started making a show about it on Cinemax or Showtime. It's Cinemax. They started making a show on Cinemax about it. It's pretty damn fantastic. The story is there's a guy who lives in a town, a small town, rural, and he's had some issues. He has a violent past, and nobody's really sure what's going on in the first and I'm not going to spoil anything, but it turns out that he has been possessed by demons very early on in his life, and he has some special abilities surrounding that, and it makes him very attractive to the underworld, the literal underworld, that he has this ability. So he teams up with, you know, through a series of, you know, hijinks, teams up with the town priest, who was an exorcist, and wants to know how he manages to exorcise, because what he can do is he can exorcise people. Basically, early on, he thinks it's by actually punching people, like just like hauling off and jacking them in the face, and it exorcises something about that physicality, but later he finds out that's not necessarily the case, but tries to find out how. And then he ends up kind of helping people in town, slowly realizes in this first story arc, now I've read like the first three collecteds, but slowly realizes in this first story arc that maybe these things aren't so isolated as more and more of these things start happening, and there's more exorcisms, like a lot of exorcisms in a small town, like way too many possessions in one small town. It's really interesting. It does something that not a lot of comic books, and we actually had an issue of Hey Kids Comics on this before, not a lot of comic books tackle religion in this respect. It's very, very steeped in societal religion and, you know, what it means to be spiritual versus being religious, as well as, you know, kind of an analogy for religion in this town and in small towns. And very interesting, very, of course, very well written. It's Kirkman. Tackles some, it does what he does best, which is kind of flay and like a living lettuce, flays and lays bare some of the kind of
leaf by leaf
degloved lettuce, so gross, kind of lays bare, flays and opens for you in a surgical theater manner a lot of kind of the intricacies and underbelly of the human psyche. It's really, really good. The art's pretty good too. It's by a guy with the last name of, I can't pronounce names, but it's Azaketa, I believe is how you pronounce his name. And Paul, and it's fantastic. Like it's a mystery. It's enough horror, and it ends up not being about the demonic possessions, much like The Walking Dead isn't about zombies. So check it out. There's a ton of volumes out there now. You can pick up and collect it. It's called Outcast.
It sounds a lot like Outcast is bringing us what Kirkman does best, and that is to disguise a lot of deep human drama, mm-hmm, and exploration of this, or, you know, the collective psyche and such, you know, by veiling it in a sort of unexpected, you know, it's sort of an audience draw. It's like, I got you. You know, you came for the zombies, you stayed for the
right,
for the character development. This sounds like exactly the same sort of thing going on, which is absolutely brilliant.
It's the Big Chill, or it's not the possessions, the demonic stuff isn't necessarily, it's The Walking Dead. It's not the bad guy. That's just a force of nature. It's a thing that's happening. It's how the characters interact with each other and their relationship building and the drama that comes out of that, that environment that creates, that really, that he uses to push those characters in different directions. It's really cool. So you're absolutely right, man.
Well, I do want to point out, full disclosure here, I had no foreknowledge of your picks.
Okay.
And then when you said you were doing modern stuff, I was like, well, thank you, because I don't have enough modern stuff in my wheelhouse right now, apart from things that you hear me talk about incessantly, like Saga, which I'm trying to get both you and Catherine to finish so I can talk to someone. I've like gone online looking for, you know, some sort of, Snapchat group or something.
You don't know what that means.
I just, it has the word chat in it, so I assumed.
Oh my god.
I don't know what the hell.
I don't either. I don't know why I'm making fun of you. I actually had a conversation last week. I'm like, so why? Why is Snapchat? I get
for
what?
For a Saga Kick group. Is that, will
kick,
that work?
Kick, sure. Sure.
Is that the one where people like can, like, you know, here's my, they can like put their name out there with impunity because it's, as far as they know, impossible to determine who you are?
I believe so. Yes. Yeah, I think that's right.
I think I've seen that where it's like, oh, just kick me. I'm like, I'm this, and here's my kick name. Like, what? You know, 5 years ago, you were terrified to give out your Facebook name. Why would? So apparently, it's an impenetrable fortress of chatter. So at any rate, in a rather ironic twist, back when we were doing the collector sector, which was the genesis, the zygote from which this baby was born,
God, the
this
gestation
200.
period was 5 hours every episode.
Oh, easily, yes. But Andrew would do the comic portion of the collector sector. And one phrase that I would hear very often, probably on about every 30 days, was Walking Dead, you know you're going to buy it, you know you're going to read it.
Yeah, still
And
true.
I'm like, yeah, and it is, because apparently it's like up to issue 5,000. There's no resolution in sight, but undoubtedly the good work is still going on. But, you know, when was I ever going to bother with a zombie book? And then I thought, when am I ever going to bother with a zombie show and watch the first episode
Right.
and decide that if I can get Catherine past the pain of the zombie idea, she's going to discover, like I did, this is just a damned good show.
Right.
It's a bunch of inexplicably reanimated corpses, but that's irrelevant. We're not here for the corpses.
Right. It's a,
And
it.
that's what Twist was. So I actually got to the point where, you know, I happened to stumble upon the first one. I think it was either one or two. I maybe even bought two trade paperbacks, like the first two volumes. And I think we're up to like 60 volumes now. But
Right.
of The Walking Dead, because I can go to these really big mega comic shops where they have like the intimidating trade paperback section.
Yeah.
Suddenly feel like I'm in a Blockbuster in like 1989, and I don't know what the hell I want anymore. And they'll have like this whole like a separate vault just for Walking Dead, because there's so damn much of it. But you know, I picked those first two up, and I'm like, well, you know, this will be fun to kind of read the Genesis. What the hell? It's completely different, yet the same.
Right.
I was really impressed that you can, as a Walking Dead television fan, pick up the Walking Dead comic, see enough that's familiar, but you don't feel like you know what's going to happen next, because it's not.
Yeah, they did a great job. Kirkman did a great job with, because, and I think that was one of the reasons that the show was so damn successful, because it's hard to draw comic book fans, canon specific comic book fans into a comic book show, because they think they've seen it all. Well, as soon as you realize, oh, this is really different, this is not the same, they
Well,
were
one of two
all in.
things happen is either you're jaded, because every time you've been promised a comic book show, it's like, hey, it's The Flash with John Wesley's ship and absolutely nothing else.
Right.
Except for a handful of artfully sprinkled references to a greater DCU. You spent the first season and a half wondering if The Flash was ever going to encounter a Flash villain. I applaud the new Flash for having at least been willing to name drop and power drop without actually still being terrified to have anybody in a costume except the principal character, but we're working on that.
We're getting there.
But you know, you have that sort of thing where there's such a body of source material that Hollywood doesn't know what to do with it.
Right.
And I use Hollywood as an overarching thing. I realize a lot of television isn't necessarily quote unquote Hollywood. Live with it. It's Hollywood. It's all Hollywood. Hey, we have
Sorry, we
everything.
aren't talking about Jason.
Yeah.
Jason's
Jason co-opted my character and his and made him even more
and
brilliant.
made him better. That's what Jason
Yeah.
does.
That's why I'm bitter, because he just took old Hollywood and made him bet made they breathe real life into old Hollywood
He's a
in some
genius.
sort of modern Prometheus way.
I'm gl
So
I I've t I've often told him this. I'm glad that he doesn't have a podcast, 'cause it would be better than anything that
yeah,
anybody's
we would
doing
just
right
have
now.
all have to quit.
Yep.
But that was one of the things that really struck me, is if you are a fan of the show and you have never picked up the comic, I can't recommend it enough, because you're not just going to see everything you've already seen paired back to you. You may be aware the Dixon boys don't occur in the comics. To my knowledge, they never have and never will. If they show up, they show up much, much later.
Right.
But so much is different in every respect. And there's a lot of things you're like, what? Because you're accustomed to these characters acting in a drastically different way. And it's a great companion piece. I think the two bookend each other very nicely because you can see just how amazingly brilliant Kirkman is.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
I mean, I fancy myself a pretty character-driven author when I do bother to write things, but holy crap, I mean, these are living, breathing characters that just, they take you to, you become very much invested in this. I've only managed to get about 7 or 8 volumes because I'm terrified because for some reason, even with the digital resources at my disposal, I can't seem to sit my ass down and make notes of which damn trade paperbacks I already own, keep a checklist like some people do. But from what I've read so far, and having watched the entire series, and knowing, you know, that a lot of stuff that I've seen now, there's a ton of just stuff that is occurring in the comics, but it's all occurring differently. I got as far as the governor, and let me tell you, Governor,
yeah.
That governor is drastically different.
Yeah, horrifically different.
And everything about everybody's approach to that situation, Michonne.
yeah.
We'll just leave it at that. But, yeah, I can't – I'm going to have to say that had I been following The Walking Dead back then, I would have concurred. You've got to read it. You want to read it. You know it. It's I honestly cannot recommend that series enough. Even if, you know, don't worry if you feel like, oh yeah, they're going to go to the farm, they're going to go to the prison. Yes, they are, but you're not going to see the same farm. You're not going to see the same prison. You're going to see a lot of things that are familiar, but there's a different take on them in what came before the show. And I just really the volume of characters, the vast differences, everything about it, it's a very satisfying experience to enjoy both.
Right.
Yeah, way better than that 2-screen experience on FX.
Damn 2-screen experience.
Yes, I've yet to indulge, but
so was that a pick, or did you just
was a pick. That actually was my picks. And that's why it was ironic. You're like, damn you, how you're stealing my thunder. And I sort of rearranged the pick to not seem like some kind of Johnny come lately.
Well, and that's the thing about these picks. You've got to understand, this is a game for us as well as like a show for you, because we don't talk about what these are before the show. So whatever we come up with, the other one doesn't know about. So
yeah, it's like a bat fight, really, only safer.
It is. It's a game of
it's a game of nerve
and diplomacy. So
yeah. And it's usually good natured.
It is. Sometimes it can get out of hand.
Very, very rare occasion.
We often are just circling.
Some more.
All right. Well, why don't you? So as not to steal your thunder, why don't you take the next pick?
Okay.
And then I'll back you up on that.
You know, unlike The Walking Dead, where you can go into pretty much any comic shop, they may not have the first issues, or you can be cheap like me and go to Half Price Books and really piss a guy off because they're under lock and key.
No.
And you got to the gatekeeper before they did, and you and this stranger happened to both be eyeballing those handful of volumes you didn't already have. That literally,
this sounds,
truthfully,
this
happened.
Sounds like a thing that actually happened. Yeah,
the big ass Half Price Books in Dallas, the big mother, the 2-story thing, and it was just, I'm like, that guy wants those Walking Dead. I can tell. Here I am walking over with the lady, and he's just thinking, I hope to God he wants 300 or Kira or
yeah.
Please, for the love of God, anything in that case.
That isn't. Oh damn it!
The fact that I left him there weeping and the. In the graphic novel section, yelling, Khan!
Right? Like, son of a bitch!
I told my name was Khan just to throw him off the scent. But,
did you just yell, my name is Khan, at him on your way out?
Yeah,
my name?
That's right. You will remember me! My name is Khan!
You will
and
remember
forever,
me
the rest
forever!
Of your life haunted by this day! And meanwhile, the people over in the old LPs are like, what the hell is going on?
Goddamn comic nerds.
Yeah, that's just what I say every time I walk by people rifling through the LPs. What the hell's going on there? But
bunch of nerds.
Unlike that. And meanwhile, up on the second floor, the ogre's yelling, nerds!
So
how Ogre got in the bookstore in the first place, but this one's gonna be a little harder to track down because this just kind of a memory was sparked as we were getting going here, and I was thinking about just the some of the really influential comics that I've encountered in the sense that they influenced me to seek out other comics. And also, this is a product of the 80s when we didn't have the internet, but we did have a handful of really good comic book magazines.
Right.
This pre-Wizard, I want to point out.
Well, back you said really comic... good. You said really good. So.
Yeah, I did. Okay, yeah. Back when a comic book magazine had articles of serious journalism about comics, and there was one, I think it was an Amazing Hero. Somebody used to publish an annual guide that they would like list hundreds and hundreds of titles you've never heard of. With the briefest of synopsis to whet your appetite that probably drove thousands of dollars, or at least up to $1,000 in back issue sales annually. upwards of $999.99 in per annum in the back issue sales solely from these articles. Regionally. But you also got a lot of insights into things. And, you know, I've often mentioned that the Crisis on Infinite Earths was sort of foisted on me by my friend Steve, who's been on the show before. He said, you know, you've got to read this. I'm like, you know, I'm a Dapper Dan man. I'm an X-Men man. And I really was resistant until I read that. And I was really impressed by just the volume of characters. And, yeah, I don't know any of these guys, but I'm fascinated by them, thanks in no small part to George Perez's incredible art.
Right, yes.
And, you know, suddenly I'm thrust into this world where you've got everything from Anthro to whoever at DC starts with a Z.
Zatanna. Let's go Zatanna.
Oh, Zatanna. There you go. Anthro to Zatanna. And yeah, because Zatanna was very much a key player. And one of the really fascinating characters, one of the breakaway characters, was an acquisition of DC that the Crisis allowed them to fold into their greater universe, and that was Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle.
Yeah.
In the pre-Booster Gold. Booster Gold hadn't even been invented yet.
Right.
And, I'm sorry, he hadn't made it into our primitive past from his...
He hadn't stolen a flight ring yet.
Yeah, he still, you know, the Legion still had most of those pretty much well under lock and key. So, the Blue Beetle was just a really interesting character as presented in the Crisis. And then somewhere in like the late 80s, DC greenlit him having his own book.
Nice.
And it's difficult. I can't find pinned down yet. The had a really good artist and a really good writer who understood the character. The artist very much understood the acrobatic dynamic. And, you know, like we all know Robin, Dick Grayson, Robin Nightwing was, started out his career in his youth as being press ganged into the family business. But it's rare you see Robin portrayed as an acrobat.
Yes.
George Perez on his stint with the New Teen Titans was very good at presenting Robin as an acrobat with an acrobat's body and an acrobat's moves.
Sure.
And the artist on the Blue Beetle comic in the 80s, I'm trying to track down. He was one of those guys who did a lot of stuff in the 80s, but I can't really recall. And I would be struggling here to conjure that up. But at any rate, about mid to late 80s, the early Blue Beetle, early issues of the early Blue Beetle comic were actually really good.
Okay.
And they're fun stories with a lot of fun characters. And it's just a neat... Paris Cullins was the artist. It's Lin Wein and Paris Cullins.
Well, there you go. You're talking about, yeah, Lin Wein.
And I think he was the one from the very beginning. Certainly he was... Paris Cullins was on there as it went on. It wasn't a long-lived series, but you can probably pick these up online or at comic shops and back issue bins. And just the early stuff was just a lot of fun because they had a lot of characters that were sort of suitable to become this sort of out-of-nowhere Blue Beetle rogues gallery.
Yeah, like, and but that's awesome because you don't consider that. Like you don't consider Blue Beetle as having a rogues gallery. You know, that's
exactly. And it was sort of in that period where a lot of new characters were introduced in the Crisis or near the Crisis, who were sort of establishing their own Rogues Gallery in a time when, you know, there were established Rogues Galleries, and anybody who, God forbid, got their own book, oftentimes were just fighting existing characters or fighting, you know, flash in the pan one-shot characters you were never going to see again. And you know, then you get characters like Firestorm who are developing a kind of working hero-villain relationship, like with Killer Frost in the case of Firestorm.
Right.
And that was also a period where it was just kind of this evolutionary spurt for DC. Marvel still continued to hold, you know, maintain their stranglehold on the market. But there's a lot of gems from DC, and the early Blue Beetles are certainly among them. Because they're very lighthearted, very much in keeping. You can also see the genesis of the Ted Kord character that plays so brilliantly against Booster Gold in later incarnations. You can see where somebody said, you know, hey, this would be, as we talked about, in Two of a Kind, these would be like the bestest pals.
Right.
It's the beginnings of that characterization where you have this guy who's a super scientist who for no real adequately explored reason can leap about, and you know, he's got his tech and he's got his athleticism and he's just having fun. And if you enjoyed characters like in Captain America Civil War on the big screen, if you had where you had you know, each camp had its own sort of little I am just amazed I'm in the superhero business with Spider-Man and Ant-Man, you get a lot of that kind of magic with those early Blue Beetles. So I really, just looking back on it, I recommend those because they're just a lot of fun. And sometimes, you know, nowadays we're trying to, we often forget that comics can be fun, that good comics can be fun. They don't all have to be, you know, dark and angst-ridden and...
You know what's really funny is that not my next pick, but the pick actually. Well, you know what? Screw it. I'm gonna go with that one for my next one. Since
this is a fluid kind of thing here.
Speaking of comics can be fun. Since Cole and I have reached a point of like mental symbiosis here. My next pick. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. Are you?
Oh no. No, really, because I'm having to draw from the dusty background of my memory back in the days where, even well before my Diamond days, this is how far back I'm going. I don't really have a lot that I can. I seem to think that the first villains were the Mad Men, if I'm not mistaken. And there was a fun kind of dynamic with them, with a very self-important leader. And I think there was a Dr. Spectrum. What Dr. Spectrum? That was the character from the Squadron Supreme. But there was some kind of like light-based character that
right.
wasn't Roy G. Bivolo.
I believe we talked about that moment when Blue Beetle died. In that same story arc, he was attacked again by was it the Mad Men? What was the
I think that was that they were bunch of guys who
like Joker-esque
they all like painted their faces like the baseball Furies from
Warriors. He was attacked again by those guys in the last story arc of his life.
Oh, that's interesting.
Nice bookend if you think about it.
It does. It kind of brings things full circle.
All right, so here we go. This is going to be tough, so I'm going to work my way through it. But I solved a Hey Kids Comics mystery.
Wow.
When I read this.
Hey, Scoob!
You
solved the mystery.
So, do you remember, Cole, when the Spider-Man wave of Marvel Legends figures came out, and there was a Speed Demon in there? Do you remember what was packaged with that Speed Demon?
Oh, yes. It was the head of crime boss Silvermane aboard the same remote control car that aided Woody and Buzz Lightyear in the third act of Toy Story.
This, what I'm about to tell you, explains it. Also explains why there's a female Beetle.
Oh.
So my next pick is The Superior Foes of Spider-Man, written by Nick Spencer, drawn by Lieber. It's awesome. So, it's and they also I can't figure out whether they stole our shtick or we stole theirs, because so the book starts at a point in which, and I don't know if you know this storyline or not, Dr. Octopus hijacks Peter Parker. Peter Parker's body, puts his consciousness in there, and he becomes the superior Spider-Man.
Ah, okay. Not familiar.
And the whole thing is almost demon. Who's the counter? Jason Blood Demon, where the longer that he stays in Peter Parker's body with Peter Parker's consciousness sort of, in cryostasis, the better a person he becomes. Because
little Peter's goodness is wearing off on him.
Right. So, but in the opening salvos of the Superior Spider-Man, Spider-Man does some pretty nasty shit. Like, beats the shit out of people, breaks legs. Not your good old-fashioned rootin' tootin' joking Spider-Man. Like, this is down to business Spider-Man. So, and he's
rearranging some faces.
Yeah. Not so much webbing people up, putting them on lampposts so that the cops can come get them type of Spider-Man.
So it's more like Dr. Detroit, adjustments to the human spine.
Yes, sort of Dan Aykroyd. But this follows.
Does he have any chicken franchises?
This follows the Boomerang trying to put together the Sinister Six. There are only ever five of them at most, which is why. And the running gag, and one of the running gags of the book is Speed Demon constantly saying we should get a sixth member, and there's this constant thing. So I was like, that's the Muggerville Seven gag. But this book is hilarious. It's hilarious, not in the same way that like a funny book would be. It's a slice of life villains book, which we never get. So
yes, that is a rarity at best.
So you've got the new Beetle, who is a mafia princess who wants to be the boss, but wants to be the boss through modern tactics like business algorithms and logistics scheduling. And she went to college, was a lawyer.
White collar crime.
Yeah, but wants to apply it to black collar crime. You've got the Shocker, who just literally says at some point in there, this is his job. He just wants to do his 9-to-5, clock out at the end of the day, and be done with it. Speed Demon's just insane and just loves it, right? Just loves his job, loves just the funny, he's almost the Ted Kord of the group. And then you got Overdrive, who's their wheel man, who can make anything into a vehicle. He's a newer character, but still funny nonetheless. And then the Boomerang. The whole point of the book, it's almost like I'm trying to think of a really funny show that I know I watched Community a lot, so it's almost like Community meets Breaking Bad, where
nice.
It's constantly they're pulling heists on other people, they're double crossing each other. It's almost an understood that they're criminals. There's this whole great. And it looks at it through a lens that we don't usually look at it through, which is the professional villain, right?
Yeah.
So, and what they're saying...
And that's something that really is inadequately explored, because what, I think we've talked about on the show is what drives you? Why would you become a quote-unquote villain? Why, there's this sort of vague aspiration attached to every villain.
Right.
But,
right.
I mean, that's a commitment. I mean, you literally have to decide, hey, I woke up this morning and I can, belch knockout gas.
Yeah, why become a villain?
Yeah.
And a lot of it, there's Villains Anonymous in this, because it functions in a world in which there's all these supervillains. Like, there's a great, later in the series, there's a great one-shot issue about the grizzly bear. And it's just all about him, like, talking in front of the Villains Anonymous people about his story and why he does what he does. And but the whole – and I'm going to spoil a lot, because it's not about the story. It's about the way that it's written, and it's about the interactions that make it such a great book. The art's phenomenal, too. It's just very good. But the whole first arc is Boomerang gets out of prison, puts the gang back together, has a parole officer. Do you know who Mach 5 or Mach 6 is?
The name rings familiar. It's probably someone I saw somewhere or on a list of, top 19 characters that ought to be Marvel Legends figures by now. Number 7 will shock you.
Yeah, no.
And it wasn't the shocker. That was the irony. Number 7 wasn't the shocker.
It should have been the shocker. He was the original Beetle. Is who Mach is. And he goes and becomes, he flips and starts working for the other side and becomes a supervillain parole officer. And every issue of this is like, it comes in with like an image of a villain or an image of a hero, and it's like, this guy, F this guy, here's why. Imagining that what we've allowed ourselves to do is as viewers of this, if this was the real world and we were looking at Mach 5, the hero, right? Or in another instance in the book, Bullseye, the professional assassin, you know, and they go through this whole thing about Bullseye where it's all marketing. He's like, I'm a better assassin than Bullseye is. It's all marketing. He's got a cooler costume. He knew the right people. You know, who he never misses. You know, they go through this. It's hilarious. But the whole first heist is he gets all these people together. And the great mythology in the villain underground is the head of Silvermane is still out there, and anybody who can grab that that Fabergé egg can then use it, because it's still sentient. He's a cyborg. It's all still works. If you can find the head of Silvermane, then you can become a crime boss.
Somehow attached to nothing, there's still nutrients reaching the brain.
Right. You can become a crime boss. So they figure out where it is. The book heavily revolves around the owl, which doesn't get a lot of play.
Leland Owsley.
But it's hilarious. The chameleon. And the chameleon's basically the where's my money Lebowski character. And Tombstone. So you get a lot of these kind of D-level players, and then the people they're scared of are the C-levels. Because you never see anybody really scared of Tombstone. If Spider-Man or Daredevil's fighting them. But these guys are scared of Tombstone, you know, straight up.
Exactly.
So they go after the, you know, there's a double cross and there's a heist, but they end up getting the head. The head goes back with, I think, the shocker, and the head is on this, in order to drive itself around, it's on this remote control car. So that's where the Silvermane head with the remote control car comes from.
That is a mystery solved, and quite brilliantly so, I must add.
This is a book, and now the book is funny enough and invested so much just in the head of Silvio, I forget what his last name is, Silvermane. Character, right? That I want to buy that speed demon just to have the Silvermane with the head with the Silvermane head with the car attached. But
I will look at the lost toys this weekend at their swap meet. So if you're listening to this on Friday, I'm afraid I was too late to get a space to sell there. But I will look to see what I can find.
But here's the thing. And it's
if I can find that loose for you, maybe they may just, you know, if you catch them on the right day, they may just sell you the Silvermane.
But the thing is, right, it's okay for a good comic book to be funny. Like, that's the same way it was okay for Breaking Bad to be funny and still break your heart and freak you out and make you turn your head, but still be funny. This is the same thing. And I can't suggest strong enough. I fought reading this thing for a really long time. I'm like, this is going to be stupid. This is going to be stupid, and I'm not going to want to read it, you know? And I read it, and I'm like, I missed out, because this is one of the coolest comic books I've read in recent years. And there's so many twists, so many turns, so many double crosses and back crosses and Ocean's 11 style heists and stuff like that, that it is a comic book that can actually keep you guessing at the same time. Nick Spencer did an amazing job. So that's my next pick, is The Superior Foes of Spider-Man. It's great. I can't give it enough love right now. It gets all the love.
Nice. Well, I'm going to take a much different angle now, because there's a book that's been a part of my reading and collecting and such for years, and I'm on the cusp now of actually owning. This is a really neat, because you can now own this book in collected volumes. I read a review of the collection itself earlier today, and one of the things that struck me in this reviewer talking about it was saying, this person was saying, this is the collection I never thought would happen.
Okay.
You know, years ago, the DC was a long time in publishing Crisis on Infinite Earths. and a lot of older Legion of Superheroes, because it was a printing technique that they used then to make these, anything that was a hologram,
yeah,
look cooler on paper.
Okay.
But it was a printing technique that went, came and went. Okay. And it wasn't reproducible per se. And I have to applaud them in Crisis on Infinite Earths. They, I mean, they could have done 1,000 different things to, you know, oh, this is kind of like what it looked like. But they wanted, it seems to me, in the reproduction of that series, they maintained that look beautifully, even though it was a very difficult process to reproduce. And in this particular case, this is a series that, as this author points out, there was little chance of this ever being collected, because the core character, the principal character, is lock, stock, and barrel the property of Marvel Comics.
Oh, here we go.
Unquestionably so. However, within the context of that story, practically apparently from day one, that character is inexorably linked to a character that is not the property of Marvel Comics, and therefore would have been, you know, tied up in development hell forever. But apparently at some point in the modern era, the estate of Sax Rohmer, creator of Dr. Fu Manchu, had, I guess, become approachable, or maybe somebody just bothered to say, hey, can we buy the rights again after 40 years?
Nobody thought about it for a while.
Yeah, it just, you know, the rights had lapsed. And apparently, I guess it's sort of a short-term thing, because Marvel is rushing out volume upon volume of the Deadly Hands of Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu.
What?
Omnibus.
What?
There are at least 3 volumes that are collecting, like, everything, even a What If.
I need to get
you
that.
Can, I know. Tell me about it. They're not cheap. However, they can be had. I did a little research. You do a little looking around. You can get them a lot cheaper than the over a C note cover price.
Right.
But these are massive tomes.
Oh, man.
That are, you know, part of their omnibus series, which are all, you know, horrendously expensive. But at the same time, they're collecting works you never thought you would. You know, I was still picking up the odd back issues piecemeal in hopes that one day I could sit down with a stack of 125 comic books and read the whole story.
And once you got out of traction, you could read the whole story.
But I can't recommend the Master Kung Fu enough. I'm not enough familiar with the earliest issues, but this is a character that started life. I once read an article that described his evolution from being a Bruce Lee clone, because he was very much born of that era in the way that, say, Luke Cage was born of the blaxploitation era.
Right.
And then rose above those roots. And I think Shang-Chi does the same thing, where he starts out as just sort of a you know, chop-socky cardboard cutout. And then in the hands of some really shrewd writers, he goes from sort of being, you know, let's have him fight Dr. Doom or Man-Thing to, you know, that was the thing. If you were a character in the Marvel Universe, eventually you had to really get steeped in the Marvel Universe, even with a lot of their licenses, like the Micronauts, where they, you know, the Micronauts met Swamp Thing as well. Or Man Thing, rather. I'm having some Marsh Madness flashbacks. It's marshmallows, I'm eating. But the neat thing with the Master of Kung Fu storyline is, over time, then you begin to get in some really, by the time I discovered the title and thought, oh, this looks interesting, I don't know why, you had the likes of, was it Paul Gulacy? Doug Monk was writing.
Oh, by the way, Doug Monk. Never mind. Remember that name. We're going to go. I got out of order. Keep going.
Oh, yeah. You know, by the time you get Doug Monk behind the wheel with a variety of artists like Mike Zeck and, of course, the late Gene Day, who we greatly lamented his loss because he really brought that character to life. You began to see, like, just a tonnage of over-the-top characters, amazing storylines that, you know, even elevated Fu Manchu out of the pulp origins into a very shrewd and dangerous character where they're constantly having to foul his plans. And a lot of it was just like, you know, a little more than testing his son. And, you know, I remember, for example, in the Sax Rohmer's works, the Fu Manchu's army were the Saifan.
Right.
And one of the cool things that Monk and company do is to, in one of the storylines, he calls in all of his various armies, including the ubiquitous Saifan, but you also have the Knights Templar and the Thuggee. And I remember thinking, oh, really? Seriously? That's the best you could come up with? And then years later, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom comes out, and everybody's like, really? Seriously? That's the best you could come up with?
And you're like, it's a thing! It's a thing!
Yeah, I read an article that apparently the Thuggee were actually a cult in India during the colonial expansion and probably even before, and that is actually where we get the English word thug. It sounded like, funny, thuggy, I get it. But actually, the reverse is true. The word thug comes from the thuggy, who would be all powerful, according to the late Mala Ram.
I don't know if that was – I don't know how accurate that is. Just saying.
He pretty much got devoured by crocodiles.
I mean, that's true. It's a tough way to go. It's a tough way to go.
You can follow him at that point. They were like, so under, you know, Doug Monk and various artists, you get some really compelling storylines. There's a great thing where, you know, Fu Manchu had his own Lazarus pit, as it were, in the Elixir Vitae, which was, you know, Sax Rohmer's way of making Fu Manchu like 1,000 years old and getting away with it. And there's a great storyline where Fu Manchu needs the blood of his offspring because the Elixir Vitae is not as vital as it used to be.
Oh, nice.
And they've been going so far as to, you know, have a note violently delivered to Shang-Chi demanding the return of his blood and demanding that his son return to Hunan province in China. And do battle with all these different armies that he's amassed together, and the Fansigars and the I forget, just like a ton of it. It was so cool. In fact, that's one of the things I want to talk about in a future episode called "You and What Army."
Oh, nice.
Where we talk about comic book armies, and not, you know, in the traditional sense, but the kind like, you know, the inexplicably large organizations like AIM and Cobra,
right,
and stuff. That, but that was one of the neat things is, you know, you have all these different things, but then you have all these over the top characters like Razor Fist, and there was one character I can't remember, a Skull Crusher, I think was one of the guys who has this sort of very traditional Chinese costume elements. And this, you know, heavy ball on a chain that was his principal weapon. And Shang-Chi, of course, you know, his own body and mind are his weapon. And he deliberately eschews weapons, calling them the purview of the weak. But, you know, if need be, he'll grab something, kick your ass with it.
Push comes to shove. You're getting pushed and shoved.
He's not above, you know, snapping your wrists and taking your nunchucks and beating the crap out of the rest of the gang with them.
That's right.
But I mean, literally, it just rises above the everybody was kung fu fighting origins and becomes this really really cool thing. You've got, and you know, his sister Follow Sui, who's sort of, sometimes she's working with, sometimes she's working against their father, and you have, like, you know, Sir Dennis Nayland Smith from Sax Rohmer's work. I don't know if the rest of the team, there's like this weird little archer kind of underground, or, you know, for hire James Bond kind of crew that predates Archer by about 30 years. I wish Archie was in.
You'd rather be watching Riverdale, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's true. I kind of got sunk in on that, but there's just all this, you know, kind of Eastern philosophy, a lot of really clever characters that evolve over time into just being dynamite. And then it also has a little bit of fun with things. There's storyline that where they go to this place, and this guy's obviously, everything about it is modeled on Casablanca, right down to the owner of the bar.
Nice. That's pretty
looks
awesome.
Just like Rick. There was one, I think, like an annual or a 100th issue or something, where they had this big gatefold that showed like all the allies and all the enemies. And that was a really cool thing that super inspired me to go back and find back issues, because I wanted to see, you know, who all these other characters were. And this, the writing is dynamite. The characterization is dynamite. You get some fun, fun and lighthearted things. And you also get just the downright violent and then like Fu Manchu with his weird Franken science. And it's just, it's got a little bit of everything.
That's awesome.
And some great, personal exploration of the characters and some dynamite costumes. I long for the day that I walk into a convention and, I'm drawing a blank on his girlfriend's name, but, to see someone cosplaying as Fu Manchu and his girlfriend with the kind of Mike Zick era costume on.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I have to get that. I mean, we've talked when we did the Hey Kids Comics Live Kung Fu Martial Arts issue or episode with Bobby Blakey, we talked at length about our love for Shang-Chi, the Master of Kung Fu, and I'm dead excited to get my hands on it.
And also, interestingly enough, there was a character I meant to mention. There was a, I think it was like Carlo or Carl Mordello, is one of the villains that he fought on. He's like this madman on this island full of robotic. It was sort of like Bruce Lee meets that Shore Leave episode of the classic Star Trek.
Yes.
Because they're like all these like, toy soldiers coming after them and weird stuff like that. And through it all was a little android, his android sidekick called Brynaki. But as a Moon Knight fan, apparently Brynaki even appeared in the Mark Spector Moon Knight special edition back in 1992.
Really?
But one of my favorite Master Kung Fu, they just, they'd occasionally have these like little breathers, and it was just this fun thing where they returned them or wind up having to return to Mordello's island, and Brynaki is still thinking he's taking commands from the skeletal remains of Mordello. And, winds up basically trying to fight this war, and it becomes this frantic kind of duck soup sort of
right. I was gonna say Strangelovian, like,
yeah, so yeah, it's kind of like dark Dr. Strangelove meets duck soup, because it he's constantly in a different costume.
Oh, nice.
He's scheming and plotting. And, at one point he looks like a park ranger or a Boy Scout troop master. And at one point he's in, Roman centurion armor as he's addressing his various robotic troops and Shang-Chi and having to fight his way through the. But he's a kind of a cartoony looking character to begin with. So it's
right on.
Makes them more fun.
Well, we have time for a very short one more before the show. We have to wrap.
Oh yes, and do you want to do the joint one we discussed, one that we did share with one another, or did you have something else?
Well, let me touch on one, and then we're going to do the joint one. Okay. The one that I did want to say was, and you said Monk. I started reading the Lemire Moon Knight. As we talked about Moon Knight, that we are on fire for sharing a mind. I started reading the Moon Knight, the new Moon Knight, and it's amazing. It's probably one of my favorite Moon Knight series yet. There have been six. This is probably my favorite because they go back to the Sienkiewicz Monk run. It incorporates Mark Spector. It incorporates Jake Lockley and Stephen Grant. So all of the different aspects, the different identities of the Moon Knight. And it incorporates Moon Knight as the vigilante, the Fist of Khonshu, and Mr. Knight in the white suit. So they really take everything and build this mythology around everything that's happened. I'm not going to spoil a damn thing because it is really cool. But go get it. Go get it.
So there's an upcoming, we invoked Marvel Legends earlier. There's an upcoming new Marvel Legends.
Oh my God.
Moon Knight.
Oh my God.
Which I've seen the figure. I'm not familiar enough with what all is going on in comics now. But what is going on at Marvel, and I think to a lesser degree at DC as well, why do all modern costumes appear to have slippers?
I think it's because of the man hours it takes to draw feet.
Boots.
I think it's the man hours it takes to draw feet.
Yeah, it's like it took me 3 hours just to get the shading.
Right, like
that's Napoleon Dynamite. I'm sorry, I get that.
We're not doing that anymore. We're not doing feet anymore. We're going straight slippers for everybody. Somebody got pissed off about Spider-Man at some point.
Like,
finally,
are they just trying to put the colorists through their paces, or why is everything two-tone? It has like some sort of slip-on, like somebody broke the part of the ski that clicks, the ski boot clicks into.
Right.
That's somehow still attached to the ski boot.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I guess to me it's the late 90s, early 2000s, what is that, Atlantis movie, I guess it was, where everybody had, during that time period, everybody had lines on their face. They're trying to do a bit of that in Thor Ragnarok, it looks like.
Oh, where everybody's painted?
Everybody has weird little lines, drawn, or circles and curly cues and filigree and stuff.
Right.
And just that was a thing for the longest. I think May Morita was a chief offender at one point.
Oh, they all were at some point.
Yeah. And what was that even based on? There was no real world movement apart from, I guess, them trying to capture some little slice of the manga crowd.
Well, I also think it went back to the Maori tribes and the Braveheart stuff. There's sort of a weird throw there.
Some artists were watching back-to-back VHS tapes of Braveheart and Once Were Warriors.
Right. So I think that's where
that
it came
sort
from.
Of came out of that. It was too late to erase it, so they just handed it over to the colorist because the inker was none the wiser that wasn't supposed to be there. It's like putting some kind of anti-Semitic messages inside your what?
What? Hey, listen, if you're a comic book writer, stop. Just don't put, if you're an artist, a comic book artist or writer, just let it go.
Yeah, especially if you're an artist, don't put your own little secret messages and things.
Unless it's something super innocuous. That, happy birthday, Ma. Even that might offend people, but
it's true.
Personal ideologies keep them out.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to put Jughead's a good American name, not as a nod to rival Archie Comics, but as just a nod to Police Academy. There's another deep cut for you.
That is a deep cut. All right, why don't you run down our last one? We've got five minutes.
Let's do a really deep cut here because it cut me deeply back in the day. And I'm willing to forgive in my old age. I'm like the forgiving Jean Valjean. Actually, I guess that's not a good analog. But
it's not. It's a bad one.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with what I'm trying to say here. But this, of course, Andy has recently delved deeply into this. I feel like I need to give it a second chance after all these years, and that is the innocuous, the once painful Camelot 3000, Brian Boland and whoever wrote it.
Who did write it? It was Brian Boland, and it's somebody that you kick yourself after you figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Mike W. Barr.
Okay, yes.
Not James O. Barr, which is what I always want to say. It would be a whole different thing if it was James.
Oh, it would have been a completely different story. But it probably would have come out on time. What?
Oh...
Sorry, guys. Too soon?
Show me on the genetically altered villain slave race monster known as Percival where they hurt you.
Yes. So, Camelot 3000 was an exciting thing back in the day because it was the first time in my own personal experience that somebody was juxtaposing things in that way.
Right.
I mean, even Captain Carrot's Oz Wonderland War was still a few years in the future. Nobody?
No, no, crickets. If I could drop crickets right now, I would totally do it.
Cricket drop.
Cricket drop.
How about Bernie Sanders?
He keeps showing up.
I know. But it's a fascinating concept in that at its core was the idea that somewhere in the mossy mythos of the King Arthur cycle, there was some promise put forth that upon his death, that the once and future king would return to his beloved Britain in its hour of greatest need.
Right.
Pissing off Churchill and Legion back in the 40s, who felt like, as hours of need go, buzz bombs are kind of the ticking of the seconds in those hours. But apparently that wasn't enough to resurrect old King Arthur. It truly is good to be the king, because only King Vitamin was slower in his resurrection. But actually, I guess that's be about right. If you twist your chronology like I'm going to do to justify my stupid joke. Anyway.
Twist away.
But the idea was that in the far-flung future, lightsaber-enabled Great Britain would be under attack from extraterrestrial forces who apparently ignored the rest of the Earth. Or we simply didn't care.
Right.
Let Hiawatha come back from the grave and protect the U.S. We're busy over here.
Hiawatha. Jesus.
It's the only iconic American.
Let Sacagawea show them how to put fish and then plant the corn so the corn grows better, you bunch of assholes.
Unlike Hiawatha, Sacagawea was real.
She could be resurrected. So was King Arthur, apparently, if you believe the mythology
so.
Of
so, yeah, this apparently crap. After
Johnny Appleseed going to ram it up your butt if you're not careful over there, America.
There you go. Paul Bunyan comes back from
that's
the grave.
Right.
Or that, and whatever the lesser known, there was actually another American giant who was sort of a East Coast legend, I think, who died of eating too many sharks one day. Godspeed, look it up. I can't remember his name. Who cares? We're working on Flight Camelot 3000. We don't give a rat's ass about the rest of the world. We're talking about England in its hour of darkness. And as I recall, pretty much random people were sort of forced to give up their own brain so that their bodies could be imbued with the spirit of the Knights of the Round Table.
I don't think they had a chance. They didn't have an option. They
no,
sort
was,
of it just
sort of like one day you're a mild-mannered accountant, the next day you're the lusty Sir Lancelot.
Well, Sir Lancelot was it was funny because Sir Lancelot was basically the Tony Stark of this book. Like, he was the multi-trillionaire futurist industrialist who all of a sudden it just bamfed into his body that he was Lancelot. Like,
yeah.
Oh, hey, this is me now. I'm this person now. Like, it was cool. It's very cool. Like, I really, really enjoyed it. It was fun.
What was interesting about it is that on with the nature of these sort of instantaneous hour of great need possessions, as it were, the takeovers were often led to unique aspects of the storyline, especially in the classical tale of was it Tristan and Isildur?
Yes, that was a good
which one. Sounds so much like Tolkien.
It does.
It's like, you know, they the authors of the King Arthur cycle went back in time or forward in time, stole those names out of Tolkien's notes, and that was all they had time for. It was like real quick portal.
Just super quick.
Yeah.
But no, they absolutely, that was the one, I think we talked about it in one of our issues where it was one of the first comics that I can ever think of, and it might have been one of the first at the time that it was released for sure, to deal with kind of transsexualism and what that was. I think it was obviously Barr was kind of ham-fisting his way through it, because I don't think it was as discussed as openly.
No one knew what to do.
But
but
it was acknowledged, and I think at the end it kind of, you know, there was a you know, I was born this way, Lady Gaga kind of come to, you know, come to Gaia moment in there that was where there was an acceptance of this is who I really am type of thing. It was
what almost cool. Becomes a sort of, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but there is kind of a cycle, a stages of mm-hmm. almost like the stages of grief, where you have this sort of stages of acceptance that I don't know how many there are in that particular wheelhouse, but you do see the character having to ultimately come to terms with this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Being a mythological man trapped in a real woman's body.
Right. That happens to be a real man that we didn't know was a real man, but was and would come back in their greatest time of need.
Yeah.
It's kind of a jacked up book, but it's really good.
Yeah. But they do some clever things with the mythos, like having Excalibur again, just, you know, crammed halfway into a random piece of rock work. And there's a wonderful sort of background scene that springs to memory of, like, some guy in a hover sled with a grabber claw trying to, you know, utilize modern technology to yank this thing out of the stone, and somebody else with a laser welder trying to dismantle the stone itself to get at the sword. Nobody mm-hmm. can seem to get this thing to budge to save him. And then Patrick Stewart tries, and then it turns out that he winds up siding with the new king.
That's exactly.
Oh, sorry, that's Paul Verhoeven's Excalibur.
Yeah, you got him mixed up. You got him mixed up.
I always do that.
No, but
it's
can't.
It's like looking into the future. Until you face it, you don't know what it's like. And then, of course, it's too late. Ladies and gentlemen, Cagliostro from Spawn.
It's pretty good. All right, we have to wrap this up. We are out of time. So yeah, those are the books that we're going to recommend. We both recommend Camelot 3000. You can buy a fancy dancy new hardback edition. You don't have to wait the 13 months between issues 11 and 12 like certain people did out there. You can buy it all at once.
You know, I often tell people, if you're a first time reader of Watchmen, gotta get that in there somewhere. You always tell people, try to, you know, don't necessarily give yourself a month, but give yourself a few days between. So if you do get a collected edition of Camelot 3000, read each issue, you know, each collected issue, you know, maybe take a day off between each chapter.
Right.
And then get up to 11, take a month off. That way you get the impact.
Yeah, and it is impactful. It is definitely impactful. All right. Well, why don't you wrap us up and we'll get out of here. Let these people get about the business of reading some comic books.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, you need to leave the sound of our voice and go and voice your desire to find some of these books. These are the titles that we're going to recommend this round, and ideally we haven't repeated ourselves. I'm being very guarded against accidentally doing that. When we do the next one of these, apparently in the next lunar cycle,
in the next fiscal we'll... quarter.
Yeah, the next equinox, we will be sure and I'll take the time to go back and listen and make sure I don't repeat myself. But in the meantime, while you're reading these, you can, of course, check out other episodes of this show and other shows on the Jedi Cole Universe Network at JediCole.com. You can write to us for now at JCUmail.com, but I started using that for a lot of personal crap, which is why open that account so I wouldn't use it for personal crap, and then now it's as full as my previous Jedi Cole one. Soon we'll have a committed Hey Kids Comics email address.
Ooh, dog!
So I can leave it the hell alone, and ideally, if somebody does write in, I'll know. So if you have written in to jcumail@yahoo.com and I've missed you, I'm sorry. I put too much personal crap on there. We're working on it. I watch for tweets on Twitter at the Jedi Cole U. And we have an Instagram or anything like that.
We've been hitting Twitter pretty hard. Thanks to those that are interacting. There's a lot of Kelly. There's a lot of Geeky Hoodie. You're out there. If you want to get in touch with us, hit us up on Instagram, HK Comics Show, or the Jedi Cole, or the Rancor Pit. All of them are on Instagram. Also, if you're listening to this and you like what you hear, head over to iTunes. Find us on there. You can find all the shows under the Jedi Cole Universe. Rate and review us, even if it's just one word. You know, good, happy, sad.
Muggerville,
Chuggy, whatever you want to put on there. Put it on there. That helps us immensely. immensely be able to find advertisers and new viewers. We're really trying to get into that this year. So so do us that favor. Yeah, that's where you can find us. So all that being said,
absolutely. And also on the Jedi Clone Universe, I have to give a plug to the other signature, the other flagship show, of course, is the Rancor Pit. We haven't done that many Rancor Pits this year, the pre-recorded show. Eddie and I are working on that. The Rancor Pit live on watchonairlive.com on the first and third Sundays of the month from noon to 1 Central. Check us out there. But we are on the cusp on May the 4th. On May the 4th Be With You Day, we'll be at Burleson, Texas at the Burleson Rec Center for their May the 4th Be With You celebration, which is the official launch of the Rancor Pit Roadshow Summer Invasion Tour 2017. That public event will be our first appearance, two comic book shop appearances, and four convention appearances, including in late May, Famous Monsters.
That's awesome.
Is coming to Dallas, and the Rancor Pit will be there in a big way. We're putting on several panels and the fifth incarnation of the Galactic Games. So if you've ever caught that one at some of the other conventions, it's been done twice on the live show, once at Infinicon last year and once at AllCon this year. And we've got a lot of really challenging stuff for Star Wars fans. And we're doing some non-Star Wars panels as well, including Favorite Monsters of Filmland, a tribute to classic monster movies.
There you go. All right. Well, we are going to get out of here because we are literally out of time. Thank you, guys. Buy, collect, enjoy your comics. We've given you some great suggestions. We want to hear yours. Hit us on Instagram or Instagram. Hit us on Twitter or Facebook or on our website. Send us emails. Kick or Snapchat. Apparently,
MySpace, Friendster.
You can find us on various mushes as
well. Wow.
Yeah. Where we get together and play LAN versions of Oregon Trail and all die of dysentery, and then we laugh. It's great. I've got 800 pounds of oats. All right. Say goodnight, Cole.
And scene. I got 800 pounds of oats that I can't keep inside my body. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Let's imagine for a few moments what our life would be like if we could access, let's say, 20% of our brain's capacity. This first stage would give us access to and control of our own body.
Sir?
Yes.
Has it been proved scientifically?
Well, for the moment, it's just hypothesis, I confess. But if you think about it, it's troubling to realize that the Greeks, Egyptians, and the Indians had notion of cells centuries before the invention of the microscope. And what to say about Darwin, whom everybody took for a fool when he put forth his theory of evolution? It's up to us to push the rules and laws and go from evolution to revolution. 100 billion neurons per human, of which only 15% are activated. There are more connections in the human body than there are stars in the galaxy. We possess a gigantic network of information to which we have almost no access.
Sir?
Yes.
And what would be the next stage?
Well, the next stage would probably be control of other people. But for that, we would need to access at least 40% of our brain's capacity. After control of ourselves and others, come control of matter. But now we're entering into the realm of science fiction, and we don't know any more than a dog who watches the moon.
Excuse me, sir?
Yes.
But what would happen if, for some reason, we ignore somebody unlocked 100% of the cerebral capacity?
100%?
Yes.
I have no idea.